about. Let me drop. I had an extremely focused performance requirement for that application. I wanted maximum forward gain, minimum standing wave ratio, and both of them way beyond the state of the art. You go out to a bid of antenna manufacturers and you tell them you want an antenna with 1.05 maximum standing wave ratio across 26 megahertz at 915. Let me drop. Had a sneeze, and the every one of those antenna manufacturers will say, we build antennas to 2-to-1 Biswar. We build quality antennas at a premium price at 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, and you're asking for 1.05 standing wave ratio across a 28 megacycle frequency region. You send out that as an RFQ to a bunch of antenna manufacturers worldwide. Half of them will respond by no bidding. The other half will not respond at all. And you call up the half that didn't respond and say, how come? And they said, we didn't know what you guys were smoking. We assumed that that spec was written by the purchasing department, who has no technical knowledge. Those numbers are impossible. We can't build that antenna. We might be able to build that antenna as a laboratory curiosity, but we'd have a yield of 5%. If we did that, we'd lose our shirt. Therefore, we gave you no response at all. We assumed it was a nut paper written by the purchasing department. With the tuning procedures I've just described to you, those antennas are being locally manufactured and being shipped, and there's a 95% yield of those antennas if you know what you're doing. So by their techniques of computer modeling, we model it first and then we build it. And with their kind of experience, they assumed it was impossible and only a crazy person would write a spec like that. Now, the anechoic chamber that I used to build and tune those antennas, when the head of the antenna department from the Midwest came and visited, he looked at that anechoic chamber, he rolled his eyes, turned around, and wanted to walk out of the room before I started talking to him. The anechoic chamber consisted of a reference antenna on my desk, the antenna on the test sitting on the conference table 3 feet away, and some anechoic material, the 6-inch repeater.
Time out.
The 6-inch thick AN79 anechoic material on the floor, a couple of pieces on the floor, one piece on the left-hand wall, one piece on the right-hand wall, one piece on the ceiling. So I was able to stop the reflections off the walls, the ceiling, and the floor, and that's all I cared about. That particular so-called anechoic chamber absolutely, positively could not measure antenna pattern. If the antenna under test was on a pedestal where it rotated, and now the main lobe is looking at the walls and whatever, I'd be getting reflections up the kazoo. Because I only needed maximum forward gain and minimum standing wave ratio, and I could tune the anechoic chamber, so to speak, which was my desk and my conference table with 3 foot of spacing between the two, because the near field range of that antenna was 1.5 feet. With 3 foot of range between the two, I could get very precise tuning of gain and standing wave ratio of only the forward lobe. And that's all I cared about, because I had a very specific directed requirement. That anechoic chamber, so-called, fit the bill completely and did the job and resulted in a whole lot of antenna designs. Whereas the conventional person using anechoic chambers in Illinois that were 30 or 40 feet long and 20 feet wide and high with real thick, half a megabucks worth of anechoic material lining the walls, that to him was an anechoic chamber. Yes, his anechoic chamber could do precise measurements across a whole lot of frequencies and measure antenna pattern. I didn't care about pattern. I had a very specific requirement. And as I said, at first he rolled his eyes and assumed that I was crazy. But he didn't understand how all these successful designs were coming out of this podunk company from his point of view. Until I challenged him to a pulse repeater.
Time out.
Until I challenged him to one of my antenna puzzles. And all of a sudden, he established a brand new respect. But before that, he assumed I was crazy. So the word anechoic chamber, depending on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to build an anechoic chamber by which you can make precise measurements of an antenna pattern, all 360 degrees of azimuth and elevation, that is a stiff requirement. The only thing that's a stiffer requirement than that is to build an anechoic chamber where you can measure radar cross-section of objects. That's a really stiff requirement. But if your requirement is only maximum forward gain on a relatively simple antenna, low standing wave ratio across a particular frequency region, you'd be amazed how simple the so-called anechoic chamber could be, and that it can do the job with high accuracy. So you have to really think out of the box of the traditional ways that people set up anechoic chambers. I wonder if that makes some sense, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That all makes perfect sense, Dick. And, you know, maybe you are crazy, but what he just didn't realize is that you're just the right kind of crazy that they needed to look for.
Okay. If you keep saying that, John, I'll keep paying you. Another check's on the way. Joe, W2RYY, I know you needed some clarification on some of this jazz. W2RYY, T2RIW.
Oh, two comments. One directly in the subject and one comment direct, that's meant for John. Number one, I've used network vector analyzers in the past. I've also used equipment similar to that, just measure return loss, like namely SiteMaster. With some of these things using heavy cables on them, like the armored cables, one thing I found from early on started using this stuff is to make sure that the cables are very tight on the instrument, because if you move that cable around after you've calibrated with the load, the short open load, if that moves on the instrument, it will change your readings. And I haven't heard you mention anything about that, but that's a very important factor with these things. And the connector can even move, and you think you can just retighten your fingers, it doesn't work. It will change your reading. If you recheck your calibrated load, you get a different answer the next time. So I found by making sure that the connections were snug to the instrument first, and then calibrated, make sure it's not going to loosen up as you move the cable around, it make all the difference in your readings. And the second comment I have is for John. The IRLP information can be accessed by going to www.irlp.net. Left-hand side, look on node info. Click on node info. Then click on connected reflectors and nodes. And you look at the particular reflector, you can find out how many people are attached that particular sub-channel of that particular reflector, like in case 9126, because I heard somebody call in here before, and they called the node, this node 4438 directly, node 2313, and then he went that node, I called in from my node, and he went back to reflector 9126, so you also may have people out there on the IRLP land trying to get in with comments, and they can't because you don't have enough time between transmissions. Back to you.
Okay, how about if right now I give a long enough delay, in case somebody out there is having trouble signing in and wants to, we'll give him that opportunity. K2RIW for TechNet, standing by for 20 seconds or so. Okay, I think for the time being, with Vito's permission, I'm going to temporarily bypass his virtual question. Turns out that Vito didn't really sign in tonight. I was listening earlier in which he and John had a discussion on potentiometers, and that in itself is a beautiful subject we should discuss. But we've pushed the mailbag quite far downrange, and some of those people with the mailbag questions are guys who are mailing in their question, and they're the high school students, and they got to get up early tomorrow. And some of them, what they can do is listen to the recordings of the TechNet a few days later by going to amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and each one of these TechNets become recorded, and a few days downrange, they become available, and the last 7 years' worth of TechNets are all, in theory, available by that means. So, John, are we going to get stumped again this week with some of those really tough questions that you get answered on the mailbag? KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
T2WGB. I don't know what you mean about we. You're going to get stumped. Vito had an interesting question, yes. You know, the reason that with two wires compared to the potentiometer? And also, it matters whether it's an active system or a passive system. So that makes it determination, too. But evidently, he's building a new one. He's having a lot of fun. All right, let me let it drop and go on to the first question. All right. Got an amateur here who has a very valuable military receiver. It's old. And it has inductive tuning. Inductive tuning has six tuning elements. They're ferrite rods that run up and down these inductors in a vertical manner. And they're driven by individual cams. Some move at a nice rate of maybe a 16th of an inch per 20 degrees. Other are moving maybe 3/8 of an inch at 20 degrees. And anyway, he wanted to know if there was a way he could possibly pick an inductor, a lump sum inductor, put it in there, and then wire in some type of air capacitor. He'd like to change the tuning system over. It's impossible for him to repair this very complicated tuning system. Maybe you could give him some help, a little advice on that, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGP.
Yeah,
by the way.
What was that, John?
It's an AM receiver.
Yeah, this is the best of all worlds. Our RF amplifiers and our receivers would have a tracking filter. In other words, as you tune from the low end of the band to the high end of the band, or whatever band you're tuning across, there would be a narrow band pass filter between the antenna and the first RF amplifier, and that filter would have this nice narrow pass band that would move with you. It would track with you. The Yaesu BC221R 2-meter receiver sort of had that characteristic. Did have a tracking filter to it. And so that was an extremely bulletproof receiver. Most of the 2-meter receivers you and I buy these days have a bandpass filter in the front end that's passing 144 to 148 simultaneously. So that if you're listening to a weak signal at the low end of the band at 144.1, you're listening to a weak CW signal, and there's a potent signal a block away at 147 megacycles coming out of a repeater, because both can pass through the front end of that receiver and into that first RF amplifier, and the potent signal overrides and then overloads it, your weak little signal you want to listen to is going to go into the noise. Let me drop. So if you had a tracking filter that when you tuned to 144.1, it passed that plus or minus 300 KC, and had strong rejection for 147 meg, that repeater, and you'd have a beautiful system. So in order to do that, a real good tracking filter, and some of the Drake receivers had a tunable filter with a knob on the front end that was a tracking filter that you manually tuned. The Drake R4C or the Drake 2B had that, as I remember. That gave you huge improvement in dynamic range and a strong, weak signal environment. In other words, you're listening to a weak signal in the adjacent area of a very strong signal. And so having filters that track is a very desirable thing. And now, if this is the best possible world, you would like the front-end filter to be tracking. The RF amplifier has an output filter. You'd like it to be tracking. The input to the mixer, you'd like it to be tracking. So in order to really do this job with highest possible dynamic range, best possible signal-to-noise ratio in a weak, strong signal environment, you'd like all those stages to tune. Can we drop? And one way to do that is by the so-called induct tuner that was done by Collins Radio, among others. Variable inductance or variable reluctance tuning. So by building coils for each of those filter elements on the front end and the middle and the back end of your RF amplifier stage, by having inductors there that have these slugs that move by way of cams, you now can have high-quality tracking filters. That's the good news. The bad news, obviously, it's a mechanical, very complicated system. And so finding ways of fixing the mechanics is worth doing. To try to do that electronically nowadays, you can do it. You can instead of have variable reluctance tuning where you're mechanically moving a ferrite slug inside of a coil in order to change the inductance, in order to tune the filter. You can do it with varector diodes. Let me drop. So by having the right computer program, so to speak, that changes the voltage applied to varector diodes that are tuning each one of those coils as you tune across the band, you can achieve that, but you pay the price. The varector diodes are not as high a quality as a real capacitor. They've got some peculiar characteristics where at the low end of the band, in other words, where you're asking for minimum voltage on the varector diode because you want maximum capacitance, and now when a strong signal comes along, the diode starts rectifying that strong signal. You can run into some problems. So using varector diodes can give you electronic tracking tuning without mechanical devices, without cams, but you pay a price. To have high enough quality, large enough valued varector diodes that are not going to run into an overload situation, it's going to cost you some man hours of design and some dollars and money to achieve that. It's doable. Another approach to the problem is to recognize that instantaneous dynamic range is a function of how much gain there is in the front end of the receiver. If there's a method by which you can flip a switch on your receiver so that you bypass the RF amplifier when you don't need it, you plug in an RF amplifier, like a advanced receiver research 20 dB gain gas fed amplifier on 2 meters that you put in the front end of your receiver on 2 meters that happens to have a 12 dB noise figure, which by the way is typical. Your all mode 2 meter receivers you can buy, quite often they get a 12 dB noise figure. You put an AR squared gas fed preamplifier in front of it and you're going to get 11 dB of improvement in the signal to noise ratio of weak signals. The extra 20 dB of gain and the low noise figure of the gas fed does all that for you. But there's a catch. Let me drop. You've added a 20 dB gain amplifier in the front end in order to override the 12 dB noise figure of that front end stage and the rest of the receiver. That's the good news. However, you've added 20 dB of gain between the antenna and the rest of the receiver, therefore the rest of the receiver will saturate 20 decibels sooner. You're running a saturation test and you're cranking up that signal generator. Because you've added 20 dB of gain, it will saturate 20 dB sooner and do some funny characteristics. So it's a mixed bag when you add a preamplifier, and if you're in a low noise environment, if you're in a low strong signal environment, it works like a charm. If you're in a metropolitan area, there are times when you want to turn off that preamplifier because it's giving you more grief than benefit. So you can sort of have your cake and eat it too if you have a preamplifier that you have a bypass switch on it. And if you're putting the preamplifier in the place where it's going to give you the maximum performance, at the top of the tower as a line driver to your lossy piece of coax cable, again, you want to be able to bypass it for a couple of reasons. One, you may want to transmit through that system. And second of all, during the time that you're not doing your receiving and the lightning storm is coming along, you'd like to have that amplifier in the bypass mode so that a nearby lightning strike doesn't give an impulse and chunk of signal to your preamplifier that might damage it. However, when it comes to damaging preamplifiers on the tops of towers, let me drop. The people who study the problem quite often find out it's not the strong signal of the lightning coming into the antenna that creates the grief to the preamplifier. You've got 12-volt wiring going up that tower, feeding B-plus, feeding voltages in that preamplifier. That 50-foot or 100-foot long piece of wire that feeds the power is a impulse noise pickup device. In other words, when a strong lightning bolt comes along, giving you an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, which is a very strong magnetic field that lasts for 20 microseconds, and there probably is going to be 3, 4, or 5 of those strikes built inside of each individual lightning bolt, if you know what I mean. It's not just, if you had a fast oscilloscope looking at that lightning strike, it's not just one strike. It's about 5 individual pulses of 20 microseconds each. Each one of them has got a huge magnetic field. That magnetic field, by Faraday's law, gets picked up by your piece of 50-foot long wiring to your preamplifier, induces 1,000 volts into that wire. That, in turn, goes roaring into the back end of your preamplifier and wipes out that gas fed. So the smarter guys would use shielded wiring, coax cable shielded wiring, Zener diodes and other protection devices on the preamplifier, protecting it from EMP. So keeping a preamplifier alive at the top of the tower, that in itself is is an interesting electrical requirement that requires some smarts. So, to answer the question, can he easily redesign that? It's going to be a fair amount of effort, John. Because of the performance he's getting out of that multi-stage induct tuner, let me drop. Because of the performance he's getting out of that, I'd much rather see him make a big investment in doing whatever is required to reestablish that broken cam system. When that system is working correctly, I mean, the U.S. government on that mil-spec receiver that you're describing, they paid a lot of money to get that performance. To throw it away, so to speak, is a little bit wasteful. So give a good, hard look. Is it possible to reestablish that cam tuning mechanism? It might be worth the effort. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yes, I have a picture of the tuning mechanism, but I don't have any idea who manufactured this item for the government. But it has 50 tubes in it, Dick, and it's all AM. It has some small solid-state components, but not much. It looks like it's worth a ton of money. But the cam is so complicated, I can see why he's looking to replace it rather than rebuild it. Some of the coils are damaged, but that's definitely repairable. The cam assembly, wow, that is going to be a project. He could probably save the lobes and just maybe make new shafts and try to put them together. It's chain-driven, and it's really a zoo, but I agree. I think he should try, no matter what it costs, I think he should, if he really likes this thing, I think it's worth the investment. I agree with that. All right, Dick, what do you think? Should we go to Paul? It's awful late. Maybe we should get his space report in.
Yeah, Paul doesn't have to get up super early tomorrow morning, so let's, if you've got at least one more mailbag item, let's go to that next mailbag.
Oh, yes, I do. I have a young scientist here. Great question, too. He has a, like a fish tank, and he's experimenting with a conductive fluid, water with some chemicals in it, and he has an interesting question. If he has a plate of, say, 10 inches by 10 inches, puts that in the water, and he has another one that is 5 inches by 10 inches, half the size, wants to know, is there a relationship with the plate size and the current, and is it a linear relationship? Should he be getting half the current than he would if he had two 10-inch plates, 10 by 10 plates in there? So he's doing these experiments, and he's getting some crazy readings, and he'd like to know your opinion and what you think he should be getting with that system. Let's see. The tank is about 2 foot square. They're separated approximately 2 feet. And the solution is conductive. That's all I know. And it's a water-based solution. So over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
When either you or I talk, in the background, I'm hearing a very low amplitude broadcast station audio. Not as much on my signal as on yours, but we're hearing it now. He's my kind of people, John. I was involved in that kind of an experiment, oh, I guess within a few months after Superstorm Sandy, because some large number of people drowned in the New York City metropolitan area during Superstorm Sandy. The majority of them drowned in their basement as seawater washed into their basement. They go into their basement in order to rescue their valuables, their best photographs, and their bowling trophies, and whatever else they consider valuable in the basement. So they go into their basement to rescue those things, and they died there, quite a significant number of people. And I am convinced that a number of those people did not die of drowning per se. I am convinced a considerable number of those people died from electrocution. And that caused me to start looking into what happens with seawater. It turns out that both blood and seawater have almost the identical resistivity, electronic resistivity. And that resistivity is 0.2 ohm meter. Let me explain what that means. Assume I had a good sized fish tank. That's exactly 1 meter cube. and I go out to the Atlantic Ocean and I pick up some 1 cubic meter of seawater and I put it in that fish tank. And on the left-hand wall of the fish tank, I put a 1 square meter sheet of metal. On the right-hand side of the fish tank, I put another 1 square meter sheet of metal. I'm now doing an exact measurement of resistivity of seawater. 1 square meter in area on the left-hand plate and the right-hand plate, and exactly 1 meter of spacing between the two, and seawater in between them, I'm now measuring the resistivity of seawater. And if I did it with the right kind of instrumentation, I would come up with 0.2 ohm if I did that. That means seawater is an extremely conductive substance. The bottom line of that is that as that seawater pours into your basement, and as you start strolling into it, and the seawater is up to your ankles, up to your knees, maybe it's up to your waist, if any portion of that seawater touches any electrical appliance which is electrified, where there's 110 or 220 volts on it, and one of those terminals touches that seawater, you're in a heap of trouble. The conductivity of that seawater is so high, it's going to be creating a current density across the seawater because, yeah, at first you'd say, well, the whole seawater in my basement is all going to be elevated at 110 volts AC, and there's no problem. I'm in the seawater is going up and down, no problem. Let me drop. Somewhere in your basement, there are grounded objects. The oil tank is grounded, and it's got a bunch of metal, and it's got a piece of copper tubing coming out of it. You got various objects in your basement that are grounded, and somewhere in that basement, the 110 volt terminal is touching the seawater. Now you're getting a voltage drop across that seawater, and your left hand leg is closer to the terminal that's electrified. Your right hand leg is closer to the terminal that's grounded, and very little voltage across that seawater in that environment will electrocute you because your left-hand leg has, let me pick a number, a quarter or a half a square meter of surface area. Your right-hand leg has the same amount of surface area. And the blood supply that's supplying your left leg and your right leg, these two major femoral artery veins, arteries, go up to the heart as two separate paths. So now the voltage on the left leg and the voltage on the right leg is being impressed across your heart by way of the conductivity of your blood supply and that vascular system. Are you getting the picture? Very little voltage drop across that seawater will electrocute you depending on your orientation and where is the voltage grounding points and where is the voltage excitation points of that seawater. The bottom line is that when any conductive fluid, even ordinary rainwater, but particularly seawater, let me drop. When seawater washes into your basement, I don't care if you've got chunks of gold, platinum, silver, uranium, whatever you've got in that basement, it ain't worth your life. Give it up. If seawater washes into your basement, do not go into your basement. Do not go into any room of your house that has live electrical circuits and you in that seawater in that same room. Don't do it. So I just described to you 1 square meter of metal on each side of this 1 cubic meter fish tank with seawater in it, and what would you measure? 0.2 ohm. And if you had the ability to put blood plasma in there, you'd measure almost the exact same number because blood has almost the exact same conductivity of seawater. Gives you another strong indication that maybe we originally used to be fish before we became amphibians, before we became land animals, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Now, in that experiment, where I've got 1 square meter of left side and right side of that fish tank, if I start plugging in smaller and smaller chunks of sheet metal on one side, the number of ohms I measure will become higher and higher. Number of ohms, more and more resistivity, so to speak, I will be apparently measuring. And now, the formulas by which you can take two unequal size sheets of metal and do the mathematics to come up with the right value for measuring the resistivity of your fluid, it is doable, it is not easy, it's not linear. I'd much rather you see, if you have to use 10 square centimeters on one plate, I'd rather see you take a pair of 10 centimeter plates, that are exactly 10 centimeters apart, and now you can measure the resistivity in a way that's traceable to the bureau, if you know what I mean. It's a relatively simple chunk of mathematics where the two plates are equal. When the two plates are unequal, as one of the plates gets smaller, the number of ohms goes up, but it's not a linear relationship, because you can picture the current that wants to flow by the zillions of paths between the small plate and the large plate. All of those paths are present. Some of those paths are longer in length than others. When you have two equal length plates, equal area plates, let me drop. When you have two equal area plates with a reasonable spacing between the two, almost all the lines of current are flowing perpendicular to the plates. They're very predictable. And you have a very deterministic situation when it comes to evaluating resistivity of that fluid. But when one of those plates is smaller than the other, now you have a whole bunch of angular and curved paths of that current flow from the small plate towards the large plate. And now calculating the resistivity in that environment, we have long paths, short paths, curved paths, slanted paths, and so on. It's a complicated relationship. You'll get a ballpark figure. If I went down to half the area of one of the plates, I will measure amount of resistivity that will be something in the vicinity of twice the number of ohms, but it won't be exact, and it's not as traceable. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Very good, Dick, because what he found in his experiment, he knows it's not accurate, but he did it a couple of times, basically the same. It seems that with the plate half the size, he's getting between 70 and 80% of the original current. You seem to think that that might be doable.
What he's measuring might be accurate, but mathematically determining what's happening, in order to model all of those curved or angular paths between the small plate and the large plate is a relatively difficult, calculation. Also, there's something else going on here. With most fluids, if you measure resistivity with DC current, you start getting polarization effects. You're really doing electroplating. In other words, you're building up a substance on one plate and you're taking away a substance on the other plate. Therefore, when you're measuring resistivity of fluids, I think the strongest recommendation is to do it as an AC measurement. You need an AC ohm meter, not a DC ohm meter. If you use a DC ohm meter with certain kinds of fluid and with the electroplating that takes place, you'll measure one number of ohms in the beginning of the experiment, and if you allow the ohm meter to sit there for 10 minutes, you'll measure a different number of ohms downrange as you start getting depolarization effects on at least one of those plates. KC2 WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Evidently, he's only measuring current, but that's a good idea. He could measure the resistance and the current for the plates, maybe cut up a few more different sizes, and then plot it. And look at that curve in the slope fashion using the secant method. I think he would be able to get an average of that rate and get a better answer, I believe.
Yeah, but he said he's not measuring ohms, he's only measuring current. There ain't no difference. Your ohm meter applies a certain amount of volts to a unknown resistor, measures the current that flows in that resistor, calculates that into ohms. So, in all cases, when you're measuring a fluid, you will do it with an AC signal, not a DC signal, if you want repeatable results. If you read the Mill Standard, I can't remember the name of it now, American National Standard Institute, C95, there's a subset of the C95 where if you're establishing a grounding rod, and there's a tower specification, I can't think of the name of it right now, if you're establishing grounding rods for lightning protection for your radio tower, and you want to know how good are your grounding rods, you're going to measure the resistance between the grounding rods. When you look at the procedure for recommendation, they do not do that with a DC voltage. They do it with an AC voltage. So if I apply my two probes to my two grounding rods that are X number of feet apart, and I want to find out how good are those grounding rods, you're supposed to measure it with an AC signal, not a DC signal, because you will get depolarization effects on the surface of those grounding rods because of the fluids that are in the ground doing electroplating, so to speak, onto your grounding rod. So fluid measurements, if you want to be exact, it's got to be done with AC, not with DC. KC2WGP, K2RIW.
Comment.
Yes, Dick, I agree 100% AC. I'm not sure he didn't state whether he's using AC, DC. And I also don't know if he's using two copper plates or is he using dissimilar metals, because then we have a problem with electrolysis. But very good. All right. That's about it from the mailbag. I think we should go over to Paul and see what's happening in space. KC2WGB from the mailbag. Back to you, Dick.
Comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Well, I have a problem with what you said. Were you trying to measure the resistivity with AC? You're actually measuring the component of the impedance. So that measurement is kind of questionable. Instead of that, you actually, for the liquid measurement, use conductivity, resistivity base of measuring pH and ORP. So there would be any conductance that is of your interest in the cell. Enter again.
On what you just said, Wes, I both agree and disagree. The average person who does an AC measurement of the resistivity between his grounding rods in his backyard does it at 60 cycles. At 60 cycles, the amount of inductance of your wiring and the amount of inductance of that volumetric material of the soil in your backyard, it is so extremely small in ohms of inductive reactants or capacitor reactants that it's very, very negligible. If I was doing the experiment of measuring resistivity of a fluid, and if I was doing it at 1 gigahertz, you're absolutely right. I'd be getting all kinds of inductance of my wiring. I'd be getting all kinds of local capacitance effects of my fluids and my plates and whatever. So you're both right and wrong. I both agree and disagree, if you know what I mean. So at 60 hertz, unless your grounding rods are a fraction of a mile apart, I wouldn't worry about the inductance of that wiring. In 2XJN, K2LIW.
Actually, it's a good point. But consideration is resistance, conductance. But then, if you were talking about resistivity to ampere per centimeters or mega ampere centimeters or gigaohm, whatever it is. But conductivity is definitely that which you got to concentrate on. Yet there are probes. There is a probe, looks like a spark gun. It has the inner electrode and outer electrode, then there is a space between, and then there is an insulator. So that thing is being used because you know the distance between one of the electrons and the second electron is constant. Now you're going to put that into the fluid. Now you have at least set of parameters that you can stand on. So you're not really doing the measurement of the cell of any kind, because then the parameters of that cell or that container vary, the material vary or whatsoever. And then you could derive the equation by trying to put the spark through that, those two electrodes, through that the medium that you have in between. But mostly the resistivity would be associated with the conductivity of the cell. If you're trying to apply the same methods that you use for the measurement of the soil in the fluid, depends on what kind of fluid, most likely it's not going to work. Anytime you use AC, you're dealing with the impedance components. Whether they are small, they are large, depends on the frequency and depends from the impedance match. And to see it.
Yeah, for the kind of measurements that John's questioner is asking, where he's talking about distances like a meter, at 60 hertz, 1 meter of wire, is giving you nanohenries of inductive inductance. And at 60 hertz, we're talking about milliohms of microohms of reactance. And he's measuring ohms of material, so it's a secondary effect, and it's calculatable. But if you ignored it for the kind of measurements that this guy is predicting to do for John, with John's understanding, I don't think he's going to run into a problem. Paul, WS2N, what's NASA doing this week? I think they've turned on the cameras for New Horizon. I believe it's starting to make photographs of the Pluto system and its satellites. I believe they're starting to do that. And I think he told me that that flyby, when it occurs, at 40-some-odd thousand miles an hour, and it's going to come within something like 2,600 miles of the surface of Pluto. Boy, that's going to be a fairly fast flyby when it comes to the perigee, if you know what I mean. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
This is WS2N. Yeah, 6,300 miles. That's how close it's going to get. And I think we went over that last week. I think it was, I don't have my notes, but I think it was 27,000 miles per hour is the relative speed distance as it passes Pluto. And as far as the cameras being turned on, I thought it was maybe the second week, I think the 14th or 15th of January before they actually start doing some science with that. Maybe they turned it on a little bit earlier. I don't know. But whatever. Yeah, this is the month where that will begin. We asked about Voyager before, by the way. It was Voyager 1 is 130 AU, and Voyager 2 is almost 107. So they're out there. 36 hours on the Voyager 1 for a radio signal to come back. Yeah, you know, being the beginning of the year, I thought I would just go through major missions that are coming up for the year. We drop it. And then we could review them as we go, you know, through the year. And of course, SpaceX is the first one that will be coming up. They were supposed to go up months ago, but there's been some delays, and now they'll be going off on the 6th. That's 2 days from now. And that'll be a morning launch, 6:20 a.m. And that'll be the fifth paid mission to the International Space Station for SpaceX with the Dragon spacecraft. And that's the one I'm looking forward to seeing if the booster rocket of the Falcon 9 is able to come back and get anywhere near to the floating platform. And I remember John asking, I don't know, maybe it was a couple of weeks ago, about how far off the coast is the barge going to be floating, and it turns out to be about 200 miles off the coast of Jacksonville, Florida. So northern Florida is where they're going to try to boost back to. Let me drop it. And also the question of which I also had, but I think John too, brought up with the waves and all. They have flotation tanks on board, which they can fill with water and then rapidly do that and somehow compensate for some of the wave motion. And they have a powerful thrusting props that are going to keep the platform within a meter and, you know, a location of where they plan to keep it. These are all tried and true gizmos that they have on board. For instance, to keep the platform located in one location, they commonly use them on oil rigs to keep them steady in one position. So, of course, SpaceX is number one. But then, you know, we've got other missions when they come up. X-Core will be launching the Lynx spacecraft probably this year. And eventually they'll be taking people up on that. That's not as big as the Virgin Galactic one that crashed, but this company is just using a two-seater. You sit next to the pilot, and it's just you and him. And you take off like a plane from a runway and rocket up to a little over 60 miles high. That's the number that you're looking for, suborbital. And then you come back and land there as a plane. The Lynx will be able to, it's being built anyway, to do this 3 or 4 times a day if they want to.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
For a trip on the X-Corps Lynx, drop this WS2M. Another flight by SpaceX will be coming up probably the end of the month or maybe beginning of February. Right now it's scheduled for the 29th. And that's a climate observation spacecraft. And they want to put it at the L1 location. It's at Lagrange Point 1, but that's the one between the Sun and the Earth. And that'll be the first for SpaceX to do that. Actually, that doesn't involve the Dragon spacecraft. The payload is the Deep Space Climate Observatory. And they'll be putting it up for NOAA. So I hope that goes well. That'll be a Falcon 9 launch. And that will also be taking off, I believe, from Florida as well. Europe has an interesting flight they want to make this year, probably mid-February or toward the end of February. They're going to launch a suborbital flight of this experimental space plane. It's a small version of what they hope to eventually develop into a full-size craft that will be eventually used for either cargo, astronauts, or both. Their version of a space shuttle or a Dream Chaser type of spacecraft. And they've been working on it for about 5 or 6 years, and they plan on launching it from French Guiana down in South America and up to a suborbital flight. They're going to bring it up to about 200-300 miles and then bring it right back down into the Pacific. And, you know, it's got wings, and they want to see how this thing performs. And if it does, you know, if it does what they want it to do, they'll eventually work on bigger versions of this thing. It's being launched by a Vega space rocket launch vehicle. European Space Agency has 3 rockets that they generally use. The new one now is the Vega, which is a light payload type of rocket. We drop it. The mid-range one is the Soyuz. They actually bought a lot of Soyuz rockets from Russia and refurbished them for their purpose. And they bring them down to South America and they launch them. That's their mid-range, heavy type of payload rocket that they use. And then the third one, of course, the Ariane 5. And that's their big one. And that will be the one that will eventually launch the James Webb Space Telescope. A couple of other missions are coming to an end. Messenger looks like that's coming to an end. That's the one that's orbiting Mercury. We'll probably hear about that later on. And then 2 investigating spacecraft, ironically going to their locations. One we spoke about earlier, New Horizons going to Pluto. Launched 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago. We'll be not orbiting, but passing Pluto and eventually going out to the Kuiper Belt looking for a Kuiper Belt object. But that'll be this year. In fact, it'll be July 14th will be the closest approach. But there's another one we talked about in the past, TechNets, is the Dawn spacecraft, and that's going to be arriving at Cirrus in March, early March. And that's not just passing it, that's going into orbit. And this is the one with the ion engines. It's passed and orbited for over a year, the Vista asteroid.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Much larger asteroid, about 600 miles in diameter. And it'll stay there forever. I won't have enough fuel to do anything else after that. And the fuel that it's using is the xenon, the gas that it was fueled up with. And that xenon gas is used as an ion propellant. So this is electric ion drive. It's got three ion drives on board. They don't fire at the same time. They fire one for months or years on end, and then they'll fire another one, and that type of thing. Another topic that we talked about a little bit is a one-year visit to the International Space Station by Kelly. Scott Kelly will be doing that. And also a Russian counterpart. That'll be coming up this year. Hubble Space Telescope, that's turned about 25 years old, but nothing new with that. And the X-37B will be going up again. That's an Air Force secretive robotic mini space shuttle, it looks like. And it's gone up three times before. Gone into orbit. Does it's investigating whatever it does. We don't know. It's top secret. And then it comes back after a year or so. Last time it stayed up about a year and a half. And it's called the X-37B. It launches from Florida on an Atlas V. That should be very nice to watch. I like that flight. That'll be in May, this coming May. There's so many of them, Dick, so, if you want me to stop, I think we better pull the plug. But the Rosetta spacecraft, we've got to talk about that eventually. This coming August, it'll be doing its closest approach to the sun, which is really around the same diameter as the Earth away from the sun. It doesn't get that close to the sun, but it'll be getting its closest approach because it's orbiting that comet, 67B. And the lander on board that landed, that they've lost contact with, they really do expect it to wake up a couple of months from now, actually. And maybe it'll do some more science. We'll see what happens to that. That's sitting on its side, and it's not getting good light. And it needs light to operate its solar cells. Another spacecraft by Japan launched a little about 5 years ago. It was supposed to go into orbit around Venus. Didn't make it, and here it is 5 years later. They're going to try it again. Same spacecraft. They're going to use the thrust as the main rocket. Didn't work to put it into orbit last time, but now they're going to try it with the thrust and see if it can do any science. It's got infrared cameras on board. And last but not least, I'll bring up the European launch, probably the end of the year. They call it LISA. It's the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. And it's actually a prototype. I want to see if this thing's going to work. They're sending one spacecraft up, and it's got a couple of sensors on board, and it's separated by... They give it to you in metric, it's I think 28 or 30 centimeters. So it's roughly a foot. And the idea is to measure gravity waves. And if this thing works, even a little bit, it'll be the first time that they can detect any kind of gravity wave from space. But if it works, it's being done with lasers and all. Many years from now, they figure the mid-2030s, they plan on putting up three spacecraft. It's the European Space Agency called the ELISE. They're, same thing with, it's got three spacecraft. One will be in the L1 position, the other one will be in the L2 position, another one following Earth, and some complex system with lasers and looking for gravity waves and all of that. But this is a test, this flight, and they want to see if this type of thing works. And if it does, they'll be able to fund the ELISA program. So that's pretty much it, except for opportunity. And Curiosity is doing great on Mars. And Opportunity, not so good. It's got some failing in the flash memory. Of course, it doesn't have a real hard drive on board. You know, they use flash memory. They would never survive a mission with a spinning hard drive. But the flash memory is having some problems. They find it rebooting all the time. We can get into that in future weeks, Dick. Back to you for any questions. Anybody else for any questions? Let me drop it. Anybody could reach me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to that K2RAWWS2N for the space report on the TechNet.
Good stuff, Paul. Let me drop long enough to see if anybody wants to ask a question. In the case of the Dawn spacecraft, which was in orbit around Vista, as I remember, and now it's about to go to orbit around Ceres by way of an ionic engine fed with xenon gas, the efficiency you get out of a rocket engine is a function of exhaust velocity. If you could make the pressure inside the chamber of the rocket engine high enough without exploding it, so if the gas is squirted out of there at near the speed of light, you'd get maximum efficiency. By efficiency, I mean how much thrust do you get versus how many pounds of fuel do you consume. The nice thing about an ionic engine is that you're sending out charged particles with the equivalent of a particle accelerator, and therefore you can get an exhaust velocity. Let me drop. You can get an exhaust velocity that's a good fraction of the speed of light. Therefore, you get terrifically high efficiency. The word efficiency in a rocket engine, they call it specific impulse. That's really how many pounds of thrust or how many kilograms of thrust you get for what length of time versus how many kilograms of fuel you have consumed. Those are the variables involved. And so an ionic engine that gives you a specific impulse, to call it efficiency, that is many times higher than an ordinary chemical rocket engine. That's the good news. The good news, bad news, the amount of thrust you get out of an ionic engine, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to guess it's nanograms of thrust. Nanokilograms, you know what I mean. Very small amount of thrust, but it's continuous. You can do it like 24 hours a day. In the case of a chemical engine, you can get tremendous pounds of thrust for a very brief period of time. So if you're in orbit around Vista and you want to leave the orbit of Vista and go to a Ceres, and you're doing it with a chemical engine, you just aim the engine in the right direction, you do a blast, and you're essentially moving straight away from Vista toward Ceres. But if you're already in orbit with a Dawn spacecraft, and by way of an extremely low thrust ionic engine, you're going to leave that orbit and go to another orbit, that's a very different process. If you just blasted the rocket away from Sirius, you wouldn't be doing anything. It's equivalent to having a rocket on the ground where the rocket weighs 1,000 pounds and you're only getting 100 pounds of thrust. You would sit there on the launch pad, burn up all your fuel,